Well, it's time now for Changing Australia. And many years ago, watching a film of a surgeon breaking and realigning a human jaw sickened some of her classmates, but not for young Barbara Woodhouse. For Barbara, it was a defining moment. She went on to become Australia's first dual-qualified female oral and maxillofacial surgeon, pioneering techniques not previously used in Australia. Barbara Woodhouse has lobbied for children with significant facial deformities to have equitable health access, self-funding trips across the Asia Pacific to perform life-changing surgery and to train local physicians. I'm very pleased to say that Dr. Barbara Woodhouse is my guest this morning on Changing Australia. Barbara, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Sally. It's an honour.
It sounds quite gruesome, but take me back to watching this film when you were a student. What did you see and what did you make of it?
I think it was the first day of orientation week, so we're all fresh out of school, and it was a Super 8 film, that's how long ago it was, and it was where you do a maxillary osteotomy, which is to detach the top jaw from base of skull to reposition it sideways, expand it, move it forwards, move it down, move it up, to basically make the occlusion or the bite more functional. And it's pretty gory, pretty messy, and everybody else is currently vomiting in the aisles, and I was thinking, wow. That's really cool. I wonder if I could ever do that.
What do you think it was about that that seemed to captivate your curiosity and also a sense of maybe I could do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. I was never sort of playing doctors and nurses or any like stuff like that as a kid. I didn't have an aversion to blood, but I didn't find it fascinating. And my main thing was I love fine work. In fact, at one stage I was considering becoming a jeweller. And when I did have to make a decision about my career, I was thinking even about ophthalmology because it's so fine.
And why do you think it was those fine skills and coordination, that steady hand that somehow appealed to you? You're yet to figure out how and where you're going to apply that.
Yeah, I eventually applied it very well, but in the early years it's a bit hit and miss. The only reason I actually ended up in dentistry was that I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was good at sciences and humanities, and my best friend was doing dentistry. I thought, well, that's a really good thing to do because at least when I get to UQ, which is enormous, and I was very shy, at least I'll know someone in my course that'd be really good to know.
Mm. What do you think about the value as human beings that we place on the face and the appearance of the face?
Oh gosh, it's enormous, absolutely enormous. I say to my patients when I'm talking about having major reconstructive jaw surgery, we have to line everything up to your eyes because that's what people look at first. And the eyes are probably the most important part of the face, and then the second part is the smile. So with those two things in mind, probably the face is what we look at in people first, last and always mostly.
Do we place too much value on it?
I think we can do these days in imperfection, but symmetry is part of our body. Right always equals left, or at least it should do. And that's what I deal in, not perfection, but restoring symmetry.
Mm. What do your patients tell you about what life has been like for them prior to surgery when we do place all this value on the face and there may be a disconnection for people about what they look like and who they see themselves to be?
Yeah, I see a lot of people who come to surgery not seeing themselves as lesser, but being seen by others as lesser,
right,
with the stories they tell me. But we also need to realise that this surgery is not done just for appearances. It's also done for function. In fact, I did a young lady on Thursday who has the most dreadful sleep apnea, and she's really at risk of major medical problems with that. And hopefully we've done something about that as well as making her look a lot better.
Mm. What does this word maxillo mean, maxillofacial?
Well, the maxillae, as in ending A-E, are the two jaws, top and bottom. Mm. But we refer to the maxilla as the top and the mandible as the bottom. So maxillofacial really refers to jaws and face.
Mm. You've pioneered the use of some procedures in Australia, Barbara. How important has that been to help the profession evolve? And how do you take things further or try something new while still trying to get the best result for a patient?
Well, being at the bottom end of the world has some advantages. Everything's done about 6 months earlier up north. And so we have the research and the stats on trying things. So it's not a quantum leap into nowhere. And you just basically think, well, that might be a good idea. Talk to a patient, say, we've not done this before in Australia, but it's well researched in America and the UK. Would you like to try this? These are the advantages. Mm. And I did most of that while I was still in the public hospital system, which I haven't been for some time. Mm. And so I was able to transmit that knowledge to my registrars, who've certainly taken it forwards.
Mm-hmm. How do you conceptualise what you're going to do in a surgery? Because there might be a procedure, but I'm imagining you need to adapt that to the case that's in front of you. Are you using 3D computer tech now to figure out how you're going to do it and or to show the patient what might be happening?
Yes, all facial reconstruction surgery and a lot of trauma surgery these days, because now we have facilities in Australia that can 3D print custom plates for fixing jaws, are done with software. So it's digital planning, okay, virtual surgical planning. And we basically take a CT scan of the patient, and CT scans have various windows, so we can see the hard tissues, the bones, as well as the soft tissues, the faces. So we put all that basic data into a software program, and then we can place or remove a soft tissue mask over the top, and then we start moving things around until they look right, simplistically.
High tech.
Well, a lot more high tech than sort of lining up your thumbs with the patient's face, which is what we used to do in the old days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long can some of these surgeries go on once you actually get in there and you're trying to solve these problems with what's available?
Look, it depends on the anatomy of the patient. So the procedure on Thursday should have taken me 2 hours, and it took me four because she had such minute anatomy. Yeah. But normally I wouldn't go over about 4.5 hours to do a top jaw, bottom jaw, and a chin, maybe if I'm reducing one side of the jaw to make it fit the other, or placing an implant on the other side to make it fit the bigger side, that would add about another 1/2 hour. So probably 5 to 5.5 hours maximum.
Mm. What sort of response do you get from patients? Obviously, there'll be swelling and incisions initially, but when they start to get a bit of a snapshot of how their face may look after this kind of surgery?
Yeah, usually they're pretty delighted. The parents or the family are the ones who are horribly shocked about how they look afterwards, because they really do have a face like a bruised pumpkin.
Mm.
But I always say go into ICU ASAP, and because that's the best they're going to look for about 3 weeks normally. Mm. And I, you know, obviously you try to prepare them for the facial swelling. Some of them may have had their wisdom teeth out before, so they know what facial swelling looks like, know what the bruising looks like. And it's not a lot bigger than having four wisdom teeth out in terms of swelling. Mm. Obviously the procedure's much longer, much more complicated.
Barbara, what's it like for people when they go back out into the world looking very different from what they did before? Do they talk to you about how they may be treated differently, or how they see all of that?
It's interesting, actually, and I tell my patients this, you know, don't expect that people won't recognise you. They'll say, oh, have you had your hair cut? Or, you know, there's something different about you. And they still look like themselves, but they look better. We hope, but certainly different. And a lot of people tell me that, yes, they do get treated a lot better. A young woman was trying to get into NIDA, I think it was, and repetitively refused. And then finally, after she had her jaw procedure, she was accepted. I don't know whether that's why she was accepted, but in her mind, it justified going through that, although she had it done for her bite, not for her looks. Mm. So that's the kind of thing. And of course, kids at school are really cruel as well. So if you've got bat ears or a tiny jaw or a big jaw, and that is the big problem, the big jaw, because in boys who don't stop growing until they're 18, 19, 20, you do the jaw when they're early to make them feel better. And then, of course, it grows adversely. And if you haven't overdone it, things can relapse to where they were.
Barbara, you've self-funded trips to the Asia Pacific to perform surgeries for people who may not otherwise have access. You've self-funded these trips into the region. What do you see?
Amazing stuff. We self-fund because in the day, AusAid refused to allow registrars to accompany us. They're concerned about being seen to be have people training on the natives. And so we do take registrars because they'll see the natural history of disease like they've never done so, which means basically it's untreated. You might get a tumour that's 2 centimetres in Australia and removed. I mean, I've taken a 2-kilogram tumour off a patient's face before now in Vanuatu. So that's the kind of stuff which is great for registrars to see. They won't see it any other way in Australia. So that's why we self-fund. Yeah, and we see kids we can't help. We see people that we have to bring to Australia. We try to minimise that because it's incredibly difficult with the health funds tightening down on the private hospitals who now have less ability to provide pro bono treatment. And it's awfully complex too. There's billeting, there's driving around to appointments, there's radiology, pathology, physiotherapy, ICU. You know, the dollars just mount up and up that people have to basically write off to accommodate the patients we bring back.
The cases that you deal with, whether it's here in Australia or offshore, are the majority of them congenital or are they from accidents and trauma-related situations?
It's a complete mix of congenital trauma because there's no seatbelts. In Cambodia, I put my seatbelt on the car when they picked me up at the airport and they all laugh at me.
Yes.
And of course, the tuk-tuks and the bicycles versus the motorbikes and the total chaos of mainstream traffic in Cambodia and most of Southeast Asia. I've been to Vietnam and Laos, the same thing. So trauma is a big part. Untreated trauma in the regions because there's no maxillofacial influence. We've trained a lot of maxfac doctors now, but even so, they're mostly confined to major cities. So last time I was in Cambodia, we did a couple of girls who'd had injuries over 10 years ago to the vertical part of their jaw where it joins the skull, the joint. And the joints have fused so they could open their mouths no more than one finger for the last 10 years.
Mm.
So this is how long it goes on and there's no treatment in the provinces at all. And then, of course, there's also the tumours. There is a tumour called ameloblastoma, which is not malignant, although I've had a case that transformed into a malignancy and required further treatment. But it is a benign tumour that can grow and completely overtake your face. And it is epidemic in Southeast Asia and the Pacific.
How rewarding is this work? It sounds incredibly demanding, but how rewarding is it for you to take part in, especially dealing with patients who've had no help for a very, very long time?
It's incredibly rewarding. I have cupboards full of little gifts from patients, and the most memorable is a young woman who gave me a lovely sort of lunchbox of stuff. I had no idea what was in it, so I just ran back to my room, put it there, and went out for various other things, clinics, and then straight to dinner, and got back at 10 o'clock at night, opened the door of my room and went, whoa! And it was durian. Down the toilet. And aircon on full bore. Yes. That was a particularly funny thing.
Barbara, it's been wonderful to speak to you today. Best wishes with future projects, and thank you very much for taking us into this world.
Thank you very much indeed, Sally. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Barbara Woodhouse, Australia's first dual-qualified female oral and maxillofacial surgeon and a board member of the Royal Australasian College of Dental Surgeons.